Welcome to Udemy Research from our Building a Micro School series by Valor Ingalls. I'm your host, and today we are tackling something that I think every educator, every parent, and specifically every micro school founder loses sleep over, even if they don't exactly put it in their pitch decks. We're talking about the soft stuff, you know, the feelings, the friendships, the inevitable meltdowns over who got the blue cup versus the red cup.
Which, as we're going to find out, really isn't the soft stuff at all. If you look at the neurological demands, it's actually some of the hardest stuff the brain has to learn.
Exactly. And that's our focus today. We are diving into episode 5 of our Building a Micro School series, the Soft Skills Curriculum. And before we get into the how-to, and believe me, we have a lot of very specific, very practical protocols to cover, I want to throw a statistic at you. It honestly stopped me in my tracks when I was reading the prep material for this.
Okay, I love a good startling statistic to kick things off. Lay it on me.
Okay, so picture this. There was a massive longitudinal study. And when I say massive, I don't just mean sample size. I mean in terms of time. We're talking a 15-year timeline here.
15 years. Okay, so this isn't a snapshot. This is a life story.
Precisely. They took a group of children at age 7 and gave them a dedicated social-emotional learning intervention. So they didn't just teach them math and reading. They taught them, well, how to be people. Fast forward 15 years, those same kids, now young adults, were 23% more likely to complete high school.
Okay, that's already significant.
And 26% more likely to attend university compared to their peers who didn't get that program.
Whoa. Okay, hang on. That is a massive difference. In educational research, you know, we are usually fighting for a few percentage points. If you change a math curriculum, you might see, what, a 3% bump and you pop the champagne. You're talking about a 23 and 26% difference in life trajectory. That's statistically enormous.
Right. So naturally, the researchers thought, wow, this program must have just made them smarter. They went to look at the standardized achievement test scores from over the years, expecting to see this huge spike in, I don't know, math or reading comprehension that explained why they went to college at such higher rates. And here is the twist.
Let me guess. The test scores didn't move.
Zero.
Knew it.
Zero advantage on standardized achievement tests. The intervention group looked exactly the same as the control group on paper when it came to that raw academic output.
That is the classic counterintuitive finding. And it drives policymakers crazy because it breaks the mental model that success equals test scores.
Yeah.
If you were looking at a spreadsheet, these kids look, you know, average. But if you looked at their lives, they were thriving.
So if the test scores didn't go up, what on earth caused them to graduate and go to college at such higher rates? If they weren't smarter in that traditional measurable sense, what was the differentiator?
It was the mechanism. That's what's so fascinating here. The mechanism of success wasn't cognitive. It was behavioral. These kids had fewer ADHD symptoms. They had lower impulsivity. They had better self-regulation. So they weren't necessarily smarter in terms of like raw IQ or retaining historical dates, but they had built the capacity to sit in a chair, to listen, to navigate a frustration without flipping a desk, and to work with a team.
They had the soft skills.
Precisely. And this really, really challenges that distraction myth we hear so often.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that if you spend time teaching kids how to manage their feelings, you're taking time away from real learning, like math and science. This study proves the opposite. Those skills are the operating system.
I love that analogy. Can we dig into that a bit? The operating system?
Yeah. Think about a computer. You can have the best software in the world installed, the best math curriculum, the most amazing science labs, the most expensive coding boot camps. But if the operating system is crashing every 5 minutes because it can't handle the processing load, that software is useless. You can't run a high-end application on a glitchy OS. Social-emotional learning, or SEL, is the operating system of the human brain. It's what allows the academic learning to actually run.
So if a child is in a state of high anxiety, or if they can't focus, or if they are, you know, ruminating on a fight they had at recess, the math software just freezes.
Exactly. The input is blocked. The RAM is completely taken up by the emotional processing. You cannot learn if you cannot regulate. End of story.
And that is our mission for this deep dive. We are in episode 5. We've already talked about finding your building, setting up self-direction, getting your tech stack sorted. Now we are asking the really fundamental question, how do we deliberately cultivate that operating system, the emotional and social capacities that makes the rest of the school actually work?
And we should be very clear about who we are talking to here. If you are a micro school founder and you're working with children ages 4 to 9, This is your bread and butter. This isn't high school psychology. This is the foundational work. You are literally building the OS from scratch.
And we aren't just guessing. We are not just going on feelings here. We have a stack of sources today that is pretty heavy. We are synthesizing meta-analyses covering over 575,000 students.
575,000. It's a staggering number.
We have specific implementation research for small learning environments. We're going to look at what actually works, not just what, you know, feels good on an Instagram post, because let's be honest, there is a lot of fluff in the SEL world.
Oh, there is a lot of fluff. There are a lot of people selling good vibes as a curriculum. We want the rigor. We want the data. We want to know what moves the needle.
Okay, so let's unpack this. Section one, we're calling the foundation. We need to define our terms because soft skills is a bit vague. When we say social emotional learning or SELL, what are we actually talking about?
So SEL, and you'll hear us pronounce it SEL, as the acronym is formally defined as the process of developing the skills to manage emotions, set goals, show empathy, establish relationships, and make responsible decisions. And the key word there is process. It's a process, not a personality trait. You aren't born with it, you learn it.
That distinction feels incredibly important. It's not, he's just a good kid, or she's just difficult. It's, he has learned these skills, or she hasn't learned them yet.
Exactly. It reframes everything. It treats behavior as a skill gap, not a character flaw, which is a much more hopeful and, frankly, more accurate way to look at it.
And the big framework everyone uses is CASEL, right?
Correct. CASEL, that's C-A-S-E-L, pronounced CASEL. It stands for the Collaborative for Academic, Social, and Emotional Learning. They are the gold standard research body here. If you're building a school, you need to know their framework. They break it all down into five core competencies. And if you're running a school, you need to know these five like the back of your hand.
Let's run through them. I want to make sure our listeners can really visualize what these actually look like in a classroom. So, number one.
Number one is self-awareness. This is the absolute baseline. Can you recognize your own emotions? Do you know what you're feeling and why? Do you know your values, your strengths, your weaknesses? For a four-year-old, this is just that initial step of realizing, I am angry right now, versus just acting out the anger. It's the ability to put a label on the internal state.
So instead of throwing the block, the goal is for them to have that split-second thought of, I am mad.
Right. Or even just, my body feels tight. That split second of recognition, that pause, that self-awareness in action.
Okay, so that's the foundation. What's number two?
Number two is self-management. This is where the rubber really meets the road. Once you know you're angry, that's self-awareness, can you regulate that emotion to achieve a goal? Can you inhibit the impulse to hit someone? Can you motivate yourself to finish a puzzle even when it's getting frustrating? This is impulse control and perseverance and grit all wrapped into one.
So it's the what you do with the feeling part.
Exactly. You have the data from self-awareness. Now you have to act on it constructively.
Number three.
Social awareness. Now we move from the self to others. This is empathy. Can you understand someone else's perspective? Can you read the social cues in a room? Can you understand that your friend is sad because they dropped their ice cream, even if you still have yours and you feel great?
That seems like a huge developmental leap for a young kid, moving from being the center of the universe to realizing others have a universe too.
It is. Moving from pure egocentricity to understanding that other people have minds and feelings and perspectives different from your own is a massive cognitive step. It's the beginning of compassion.
Okay, that makes sense. Number four.
Relationship skills. This is the practical application of social awareness. It's communication, active listening, cooperation, navigating conflict peacefully. It's the ability to work in a team and not just coexist, but actually collaborate. It's knowing how to ask for what you need without attacking the other person.
And number five.
And finally, number five is responsible decision making. This is the ethical component. It's about making choices based on safety, on social norms, and on the well-being of yourself and others. It's that stop and think moment before you do something risky or potentially hurtful. It's the culmination of all the other skills.
So those are the five pillars: self-awareness, self-management, social awareness, relationship skills, and responsible decision-making. But here's where it gets really, really interesting for anyone designing a curriculum. I was looking at that Cipriano L. meta-analysis from 2023. Which is massive, by the way, over 400 studies. And they found something incredibly specific about the order in which you teach these things.
Yes, this is the sequencing insight. And it is absolutely crucial for curriculum design. It's one of those findings that seems obvious in hindsight, but so many programs get it wrong. They found that programs that teach interpersonal skills first.
The self stuff.
Right, the self stuff. Self-awareness and self-management. Programs that taught those first, and then moved to the interpersonal skills, social awareness and relationships, dramatically outperformed programs that tried to teach them all at once, or worse, in reverse.
That makes so much intuitive sense, but it's so easy to get wrong. I feel like a lot of schools jump straight to be nice to your friends or share your toys before the kid even knows how to handle their own body.
Exactly. Think about it. You cannot effectively manage a conflict with a peer, which is a high-level interpersonal skill, if you cannot first recognize that you are angry and then regulate that anger. That's all interpersonal. If you skip the self-regulation part, the conflict resolution part is just a lecture that the kid can't possibly follow because their nervous system is on fire. The progression must be inside out.
Inside out. I like that imagery. You have to build the container for yourself before you can try to interact with other people's containers.
Precisely. If your own house is on fire, you can't help your neighbor paint their fence. You have to handle the internal state first.
So if you're a founder mapping out your school year, you don't start week one with how to share. You start week one with how to know what you're feeling.
You start with the self. You normalize the internal language. What am I feeling? Where is it in my body? How big is the feeling? What can I do about it?
Only when that language is established and practiced do you move to how is he feeling? How can we solve this problem together?
Now, we have to talk about the specific context we are in right now. We are recording this for January 2026. The cohort of children entering microschools right now, the 4, 5, and 6-year-olds, they have a very specific shared history.
They do, and we absolutely cannot ignore it. These children who are, say, 5 years old in 2026, they were toddlers in 2021. They were 2, 3, and 4 years old during the height of the pandemic lockdowns.
Right, those foundational years where they would normally be starting playgroups, going to the park, seeing other faces, learning to read social cues from people who weren't their parents. Exactly, and we have hard data on this. There was a major scoping review in PLOS Global Public Health from September 2024, and another big report from Curriculum Associates in 2024. They paint a very specific and, frankly, a pretty concerning picture of this particular cohort.
So what are we seeing? Is it just that they are a little behind schedule?
It's more specific than that. It's not a uniform delay. We are seeing persistent deficits compared to pre-pandemic baselines in very specific areas. Specifically, difficulty sharing, a noticeable regression in cooperative play, meaning they play next to each other in parallel, but they really struggle to play with each other, and significant challenges with emotional regulation. The fuses are just shorter.
And this isn't just a case of kids being kids. This is measurably different.
It is measurably different. The research shows that while older students, the ones who were, say, in middle school during the pandemic, are generally catching up academically and socially, the youngest children, the ones who are pre-verbal or just learning to socialize, are remaining below pre-pandemic benchmarks. They missed those critical, high-volume, low-stakes socialization windows, playgroups, preschool, playground interactions that wire the brain for us, not just me.
So if you're opening a microschool in 2026, you cannot assume a 2019 baseline of social skills.
You absolutely cannot. It would be a critical error. If you assume these 5-year-olds are coming in knowing how to take turns or knowing how to self-soothe after a small disappointment, you're going to be constantly frustrated and they're going to feel like they're constantly failing. You have to meet them where they are. And that might mean your timeline for those foundational inside-out skills needs to be extended. You might need to spend 3 months on how to share space, whereas in 2019, you might have spent 3 weeks.
That is such a critical pivot for a founder to hear. It's not that the kids are broken. It's that their context was different, so the curriculum has to adapt to meet that reality.
Correct. It's an environmental adaptation. You are filling in the developmental gaps that the environment failed to provide during those crucial lockdown years. Mm. It's remedial work, in a way, but it's essential.
Okay, let's move into the evidence. We've established the K-cell framework and the who, this specific pandemic cohort. Now let's talk about the how. What actually works? Because there is a whole industry of SEL products out there, and I imagine not all of them are created equal.
Not even close. But the good news is we have some very heavy-hitting data to guide us. We mentioned the Cipriano study from 23, but we also have the truly foundational meta-analysis from Durlach et al. In 2011. Between those two, they cover 53 countries, and as you said, nearly 600,000 students.
That sample size is it's incredible. It's basically the population of a small country. You can't argue with that scale.
It gives us very, very high confidence in the general findings.
And when we talk about effectiveness in these studies, we usually talk about effect size. For our listeners who might not be stat heads, can you give us a quick, rule of thumb on that?
Sure, happy to. In social science, an effect size is a standard way to measure how much of a difference an intervention makes. Generally speaking, an effect size of 0.2 is considered small, 0.5 is medium, and 0.8 is large. Honestly, most educational interventions fight tooth and nail to get a 0.2 or 0.3. If you find something that is consistently hitting 0.4 or higher, you really pay attention.
Okay, so where does SEL sit on that spectrum?
Well, SEL programs typically range from around 0.1 to 0.6, depending on what outcome you're measuring. Now, that might sound modest, but here is the key. They are incredibly consistent, and they accumulate over time. Durlach's big finding was an 11 percentile point gain in academic achievement.
Okay, break that down. What does that mean for an actual kid?
It means the average kid, the kid in the 50th percentile who is in the SEL program, moved to the 61st percentile in their academic scores. They did that just by working on soft skills.
That is significant. That can be a letter grade difference for a lot of kids.
Exactly. And remember, that's an academic gain from a non-academic intervention. That's the part that's so powerful.
But here is the data point that I think will be the most, controversial, or at least the most validating for our micro school founders. There's a huge debate about who should teach this. Do you hire the expensive specialist to come in once a week and do a session, or does the regular classroom teacher do it?
This is one of the strongest and most consistent findings in the entire body of literature. Teacher-delivered programs have an effect size of 0.34 on academic performance. External specialist delivery hiring that outside expert to come in is only 0.12.
Wow. Okay, so hold on. The teacher is nearly three times more effective than the specialist.
Yes, and we need to really understand why. Because it's not intuitive for everyone. It's not because the teacher necessarily knows more about psychology. In fact, the specialist usually knows more the theory.
So why does the teacher win by such a huge margin?
Because the specialist is a drop-in event. They come in on Tuesday at 10 a.m., they do a puppet show about kindness, and then they leave. The teacher, or the guide in a micro school, is there for the other 6 hours of the day. They can embed the skills into daily practice. They are there for the teachable moments.
So when a conflict happens over blocks at lunch, the teacher is right there to say, hey, remember what we talked about with the puppets? Let's try that now. The specialist is in their car, driving to the next school.
Exactly. SEL isn't a lecture. It's a practice. It's a skill you have to use in real time under stress. You need someone who is present in the moment of conflict, because the moment of conflict is the moment of learning. If the person who taught the skill isn't there to coach the application of that skill, the transfer just doesn't happen for most young kids.
So the big implication for founders is, do not outsource this. You or your guides are the most powerful vehicle for delivery. Save your money on the weekly consultant and invest it in training your own team.
Absolutely. The relationship is the intervention. A stranger coming in once a week doesn't have the relational capital, the trust, to change behavior the way a trusted daily guide does. It's not even close.
That leads right into the next big debate. How do you teach it? Is it a separate lesson like, okay, everyone, put away your math books, it's time for empathy class, or is it just something that's woven into the fabric of the day?
The explicit versus integrated debate. And for a long time, people in education really thought you had to choose one. The progressive educators wanted it all woven in, just make it part of the culture, in the air. The traditionalists wanted a clear lesson plan with objectives.
And what does the research say?
The research says, unequivocally, you need both. You need to do both. There was a fascinating study called the Head Start RDI study. They looked at a program that just tried to integrate SEL into literacy. So, reading books about feelings, creating a nice warm environment. They found that those literacy gains alone did not improve behavior. You needed explicit instruction, dedicated time to teach the actual skill, PLFS, the constant integration throughout the day.
So you can't just read The Giving Tree and hope the kids magically become generous.
Exactly. You have to actually teach explicitly. Mm-hmm. This is what generosity looks like. This is how it feels in your body. Let's practice it. Mm-hmm. And then you read The Giving Tree to see it in a story. The explicit instruction gives them the vocabulary and the mental model. The integration gives them the context and the practice.
The sources mention that there's a sweet spot for integration, though. It's not like every subject is equally good for this.
Right. And this is a practical tip for curriculum design. Literacy is the king of SEL integration. Character analysis, perspective taking, understanding motivation. It's naturally built into stories. Why did the wolf blow down the house? How do you think the pig felt? That's pure social awareness.
What about math and science? Is it harder there?
It is much harder, and it can feel really forced if you try to make, say, long division an emotional experience.
Yeah.
How does the number 7 feel about being divided by 3? It just, it doesn't work. It feels patronizing to the kids, and they see right through it.
So for math, the skill is different.
Yes. Math is better for practicing self-management. How do you deal with the frustration of a really hard problem without giving up? That's a powerful SEL lesson, but it's about the process, not the content.
Okay, so we need explicit instruction delivered by the main teacher, plus integration, especially in literacy. But what makes a program, you know, good? The research always talks about the SAFE criteria. Can you walk us through that acronym?
SAFE, yes. If you are a founder and you're evaluating a curriculum to buy for your school, run it through this 4-part filter. It comes from the Durlach meta-analysis, and it's a great predictor of success.
Okay, S stands for?
Sequenced. Does the program have a logical flow? Does it build skills step by step? Or is it just a random collection of fun activities?
Yeah.
You need to learn A before you can do B. It has to be developmentally sequenced.
And A stands for?
Active. The kids have to do something. They have to be engaged in active forms of learning, role-playing, practicing a skill, moving their bodies. If they are just sitting and listening to a lecture, it's not active. I mean, you can't learn to ride a bike by watching a PowerPoint. You can't learn SEL by listening to someone talk about it.
Makes sense. F.
Focused. You need dedicated, protected time. You can't just say, oh, we do SEL all day. You need to have focused attention on developing specific skills.
Right now, for the next 15 minutes, we are working on listening.
Explicit. You have to name the skill you are targeting. Today, we are learning about self-control. Don't make the kids guess what the point of the lesson is. Be crystal clear.
Sequenced, active, focused, explicit. S-A-F-E. That is a fantastic checklist for any founder looking at a shiny curriculum PDF and wondering if it's actually worth the money.
It cuts through the marketing hype and gets to the pedagogical core instantly.
Now the million-dollar question. How much time does this take? Because as we know, microschool schedules are incredibly tight. Every single minute is fought for.
The dosage question, yes.
Yes.
The PA-HS program meta-analysis looked at this very closely, and they found that dosage was the predominant factor in success. The magic number, the minimum effective dose, seems to be about 75 minutes per week.
75 minutes, so an hour and 15 minutes a week.
Right. And for the age group we're talking about, 4 to 9, you absolutely do not do that in one big block. Their attention spans can't possibly hold it. You have to break it down. Approximately 15 minutes a day.
Okay, that feels much more manageable. 15 minutes a day of that explicit SAFE instruction, plus the integration throughout the rest of the day.
Exactly. Frequency beats intensity here. It's far better to do 15 minutes every single day than one massive 75-minute session on a Friday afternoon. It keeps the language alive. It becomes part of the daily rhythm and culture of the school.
I want to pause here for a second and address the elephant in the room. We are applying all this incredible research to microschools, but is there actually any research on microschools and SEL?
That is the tension, and it's an important one to name. The honest answer is direct peer-reviewed research on microschool SEL outcomes is, right now, limited to absent. Most of these huge studies, Durlach, Cipriano, they come from conventional classrooms. You know, one teacher and 30 kids.
So we are extrapolating.
We are. But it's very logical, very sound extrapolation. Microschools have a massive theoretical advantage. When you have low ratios, like 1 adult to 12 kids or 1 to 8, you allow for real-time coaching and observation that simply isn't possible in a 1 to 30 classroom. In a big class, the teacher might miss the moment a conflict starts bubbling up. In a microschool, the guide is right there. They can intervene and coach in the moment.
So the environment itself is primed for better SEL, but we have to be careful not to claim it's a scientifically proven advantage just yet.
Correct. Microschools right now are effectively natural experiments. The logic holds up beautifully, but we need to see the longitudinal data over the next decade. But think about it. If SEL relies on relationships and individualized coaching, a smaller, more intimate environment should be the ideal petri dish for this work.
This raises a really important point for the founders listening. If you have the structural advantage, you have a responsibility to use it deliberately. Mm. You can't just rely on the small size to magically do the work. You need protocols.
And that brings us perfectly to section 3. Application. Let's get out of the theory and into the practice. How do we actually run this in a real room with 12 kids ages 4 to 9?
Let's get tactical. Protocol number 1, the daily structure, specifically the morning meeting. The sources say this is pretty much non-negotiable.
It is. If you do nothing else from this entire deep dive, Do this. 15 to 20 minutes to start every single day. It anchors everything. It is the boot up sequence for the social-emotional operating system.
Okay, walk us through the essential components. What has to be in that 15 minutes?
Component one, the greeting. This seems so trivial, but neurologically it's not. Every single child is greeted by name, by an adult, at the door of the circle. But here's the micro school twist. Give them autonomy. The child chooses the greeting. Do they want a handshake, a high five, or just a verbal hello?
I've seen this in action. It gives them this tiny, powerful moment of control right as they walk in. Today, I choose a high five. It's empowering.
Exactly. Connection plus autonomy. You are saying, I see you, and your choices matter here. Component two, the feelings check-in. You must have visual aids for this, especially for the younger ones. The zones of regulation colors are perfect for this. Blue for sad, tired, green for focused, calm, yellow for silly, anxious, and red for angry, out of control.
I'm in the yellow zone today.
It normalizes talking about your internal state.
And it helps them separate the feeling from their identity. I am in the yellow zone is very different from saying I am bad.
Yes, it objectifies the emotion. It's just data. And once it's data, they can learn to manage it. Component three, a story or a share. A very brief SEL-focused picture book or a simple sharing prompt. Tell us about a time you felt brave. This builds that social awareness competency listening to others' experiences.
And finally, goal setting.
Yes, and this connects directly to self-management. Have them set a concrete, observable goal for the day. Not something vague like be good, but something specific like I will wait my turn to speak or I will finish my drawing before starting something new. It makes the abstract skill of self-management concrete.
So why does that specific combination, greeting, check-in, share, goal work so well?
Because it creates a predictable, safe touch point. The human brain craves predictability to feel safe, especially for kids. They know they will be seen, individually acknowledged, before they are asked to perform academically. That feeling of safety is the absolute prerequisite for learning. If a child walks in anxious, the check-in catches it. If they walk in scattered, the goal setting focuses them. It tunes the entire group to the same frequency.
Okay, protocol two. This one I think is so often misunderstood. The calm down corner.
Yes. We need to reframe this immediately. It is not a timeout. It is not a punishment. It is not a place of shame. It is a regulation resource.
So you would never say go to the calm down corner because you were bad.
Never. That poisons the well forever. You say, it looks like your body is having a hard time regulating. Would the calm down corner help you feel ready to join us again? It's an invitation. It's an offer of help, not a sentence.
What goes in there? What are the tools?
Soft lighting, comfortable seating, a beanbag, some pillows, and tools. Glitter bottles are absolutely fantastic. It's just a sealed water bottle with glitter and glue. You shake it up and you watch the glitter slowly settle. It forces you to slow down your breathing and focus your eyes. It's a physical hack for the nervous system. Mm-hmm. Also, breathing guides, like a picture of a star you trace with your finger as you breathe in and out. Fidgets, anything that gives sensory input.
And why is this so necessary for that 4 to 6 age group in particular?
Because biologically, their prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain that says, calm down, it's not a big deal, is not fully online yet. It's under construction. They cannot regulate purely cognitively. They can't just think themselves calm. They need physical tools and environmental support, that's called co-regulation, before they can learn to self-regulate. The corner acts as a sort of external brain to help them soothe their system.
Protocol three, the weekly structured lesson. This is where we hit that 75 minutes a week dosage. We need a dedicated block for the explicit teaching.
Right. 30 to 45 minutes once a week, and you follow that safe structure,
right,
or warm-up, then the explicit instruction, the teacher models the skill, the kids do guided practice, and you end with a brief reflection. This is where you actually teach the concepts you'll be integrating all week.
Can you give us a really concrete example? The turtle technique came up in the sources. I love the name.
The turtle technique is a classic from the preschool PATH EHS program. It's a physical, concrete strategy for when you feel angry or overwhelmed. Step one, stop what you're doing. Step two, go into your shell. You physically wrap your arms around yourself and lower your head. Step three, take three deep breaths while you're in your shell. Step four, when you feel calm, come out and think of a solution.
It's so physical. It's a whole body action.
It has to be. You can't tell a four-year-old, I want you to regulate your amygdala. You tell them, do the turtle. It gives them a physical script for their body when their thinking brain is offline. The physical action of hugging yourself actually provides deep pressure input, which is neurologically calming. It's brilliant.
I can absolutely see that working. Now, Protocol 4 is the really tricky one for microschools specifically, the mixed age group. You have a 4-year-old and 9-year-old sitting in the same morning meeting circle. How do you teach SEL to both of them at the same time without boring the older one or completely confusing the younger one?
This is the tiered participation strategy, and it's a game changer for mixed age environments. You differentiate the role, not just the content. Everyone's learning about, say, frustration, but their job within the lesson is different depending on their age.
Okay, break that down by age for me.
Okay, so you're 4 and 5 year olds. Their focus is on identification. Can they just name the feeling? You show them a puppet and ask, is the puppet angry or sad? That's it. They are learning the basic labels. You're 6 and 7 year olds. Their focus is on communication. They've moved past just naming it. Now they need to use I statements. I feel angry when. They're learning to construct sentences that communicate their feelings. Then you're 8 and 9 year olds. Their focus is on facilitation. You make them the leaders. They can be peer mediators in a conflict. They can help coach the younger ones through the turtle technique. They can lead a part of the discussion.
That is absolutely brilliant. It turns the age gap from a problem into an asset. The 9-year-old feels important and mature because they are helping, which reinforces the skill for them even more deeply than just listening to a lesson would.
Exactly. Teaching is the best way to learn. By coaching the 4-year-old, the 9-year-old has to internalize the lesson on a whole new level. You are giving the older kids a genuine sense of purpose and responsibility, which is huge for their own self-esteem and leadership skills.
Let's talk brass tacks. Implementation and budget. SEL can be really expensive if you buy the big, shiny curriculum kits. What is the financial reality for a startup micro school?
The cost can range dramatically, from maybe $3,000 for a really lean setup to $25,000 for a premium all-inclusive package. But here is the single most important insight from the implementation research. Spending your money on implementation support, that means professional development, coaching the teacher, having an expert observe the classroom and give feedback, is infinitely more valuable than buying the expensive docs and materials.
So don't blow the whole budget on the fancy puppets if you aren't going to train the teacher on exactly how to use them effectively.
A generic, low-cost kit with great coaching will beat a premium kit with no training every single time. If you have $5,000 to spend, spend $1,000 on the curriculum materials and $4,000 on getting an expert to observe your guides and give them real-time feedback. That's where you'll see the results.
Are there any recommended programs that fit this lean but effective model that founders should look into?
Definitely. Second Step Early Learning is fantastic. It uses puppets, songs. It's very structured. Preschool Pad H is the one with the turtle technique we mentioned. Positive Action has some incredible cost-effectiveness data behind it. And Zones of Regulation is a must-have for the visual framework we talked about for the morning check-in. You can get started with the Zones framework for very little money, but the impact on giving kids a language for their feelings is huge.
Okay, last piece of the application puzzle, assessment. And this feels like a minefield. The politics of SEL they're intense right now.
They are. And we have to acknowledge the polarization. In 2026, you have some states that mandate SEL in public schools, and you have others that have effectively banned it or labeled it a neglect of duty for teachers. It's become a real culture war topic.
So how does a micro school, which often has more freedom but is also more accountable to its parents, navigate that? And how do you assess these skills without being creepy or political?
The golden rule of SEL assessment is this. Do not use these measures for student accountability or grading. Do not ever give a child a C in empathy. That is destructive, it's ethically shaky, and it misses the whole point.
So what do you measure instead, if not the child?
You measure the implementation fidelity. You grade the school, not the child. Are we the adults doing the morning meeting every single day? Are we using the curriculum as it was written? Are we hearing the kids start to use the vocabulary in the classroom? You assess your own practice.
And for communicating with parents?
You use qualitative data, anecdotal notes, and portfolios. Here is a moment where your child helped a friend who was sad. Here's a goal they set for themselves and work towards all week. It's storytelling, not scoring. And regarding the politics, transparency is your best defense. Don't hide what you're doing behind acronyms. Explain what you are teaching in plain language. We teach focus. We teach how to be a good friend. We teach how to solve problems without hitting.
That's great advice. It's hard to argue with, We are teaching your child how to focus and be kind.
Exactly. When you strip away the jargon and show the actual tangible skills, almost every single parent, regardless of their politics, wants their child to have them.
We have covered a massive amount of ground, from that 15-year study all the way down to the turtle technique.
It's a lot, but it's the operating system. You just can't skip it. The academic house is built on this foundation.
I want to circle all the way back to where we started, that incredible 15-year study. We mentioned the kids were more likely to graduate high school and go to college, but the study didn't stop there, did it? They kept following them.
No, it didn't. They followed them all the way to age 24, and the differences just kept compounding. Mm. The SEL group had higher rates of stable, full-time employment. They had better health outcomes, both mental and physical. They were significantly less likely to be involved in the criminal justice system.
So these skills, learning to wait your turn in a circle, learning to name your anger at age 7, they actually compound over decades into a different life.
It's the compound interest of human development. A small early investment in self-regulation at age 5 pays out massive dividends in your career and your health at age 25. The ability to handle stress, to work with others, to stay motivated when things get tough, those are the ultimate differentiators in the adult world.
So for the founder listening to this who is completely overwhelmed by the building permits, the tech stack, the parent emails, if they can only do one thing from this entire deep dive, what is it? What's the highest leverage point?
If you do nothing else, implement the morning meeting. That 15 minutes of dedicated connection, the feelings check-in, plus the goal setting is the highest ROI activity you can possibly do. It sets the tone for the entire culture. It tells every child every single day, you matter here, your feelings are valid, and we are here to do this work together. It's everything.
I love that. Start the day right, and the rest follows. And I'll leave you with this final provocative thought. We talked about how microschools are natural experiments. That means you, the founder, are the researcher. You have a structural advantage, deep relationships, low ratios that large systems can't possibly match. Your implementation of this work is effectively applied research. You are documenting what works in an intimate, human-scale context. Take that responsibility seriously. You aren't just starting a school. You are pioneering the future of how we humanize education.
Well said. A perfect place to end.
Thank you so much for diving deep with us today.
It was my pleasure.
As always, you can find the full research, the meta-analyses, and all the sources we discussed at research.uda.me. That's yuda.me. We'll see you in the next episode.